Hello, XX listeners, and welcome to this special podcast. I'm Julia Turner, editor-in-chief of Slate. In recent weeks, more than 75 women have come forward to accuse movie producer Harvey Weinstein of sexual harassment and assault. The stories that Weinstein's accusers tell, of uncomfortable encounters in hotel rooms, of ostensible business meetings interrupted by requests to give him a massage, to watch him shower, to disrobe, and sometimes of sexual violence, including rape, echo each other in striking ways. In many cases, these women also describe having spent decades feeling isolated, alone, and ashamed of their brushes with Weinstein. But they were far from alone, and so we invited three of these women, actress Alice Evans, actress Catherine Kendall, and professor of psychology Tomi Ann Roberts, to speak with each other about their experiences. In an honest and emotional conversation taped in Los Angeles on Thursday, November 16th, they described what happened to them and how they're feeling now about the cascade of Weinstein stories and allegations against other powerful men that have emerged. Before we bring you that conversation, I'll note that Weinstein has been fired from the Weinstein Company and has resigned from the company's board. Through a spokesperson, he has denied all allegations of non-consensual sex and of retaliation against women who rebuffed him or complained about his behavior. Now, that conversation. My guests today include Alice Evans, an actress who has appeared on The Vampire Diaries and Lost. Thanks for joining me, Alice.
Thank you.
And also here in the studio with me is Catherine Kendall, a photographer and actress, perhaps best known for her role in the film Swingers. Thanks for being here today, Catherine.
Thank you.
And joining us by Skype from Colorado is Tomi Ann Roberts, a professor of psychology at Colorado College. Welcome, Tomi Ann.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
The Weinstein encounters you three have described took place in three different decades, which strikes me as a testament to the immense scope of what we've learned about Weinstein's behavior over decades, in the 80s, the 90s, and the early aughts. Tomi Ann, I'd like to start with your story. Can you describe how and when you met Harvey Weinstein and what happened?
I was in between my junior and senior year in college, and a number of my college friends and I lived in New York that summer doing things like internships. And I had been considering both a theater major and a psychology major actually at Smith College. And so that summer was an opportunity for me to do some auditions for commercials, get some headshots, things like that. I was working at a restaurant, and it was at this restaurant that I met the Weinstein brothers, who introduced themselves to me as a production company. I remember learning about how they named their company Miramax after their parents. Before I knew it, Harvey had indicated, you know, when I said that I was an aspiring actress, that they were now going to be doing their first movie that they would be directing. They had been, I think, prior to that, importing foreign movies. And so that was very exciting, as you might imagine. And for the rest of the summer, I would receive scripts and updates about the movie. I remember going to the offices at one time. And then I was invited to an apartment. I presumed that other people involved with the movie would be at this evening event, because why would I be invited to something in the evening? And I arrived at this apartment to find Harvey. He called me down the hall. He was in the bathtub. And I stood there frozen, of course. I've since wondered, you know, why would something like that be so frightening? You know, here's a man in a bathtub.
There's the surprise of it. I mean.
Exactly. Exactly. And sort of, I don't know, the temerity of him to think, I'm just going to present myself to you in this way. And, you know, knowing that that would be very off-putting to me, he tried to calm me down and say, you know, that nakedness was something that I needed to be comfortable with. Would I please take my top off? Because surely the movie would have some nudity scenes, and I needed to show him that I was comfortable with that, which, of course, I wasn't.
What did you say?
Well, I know I wish I could remember my exact words. It was such a flooding experience, but I do know, and I'm ashamed to say, that I was not aggressive in any way. I was terribly frightened of poking this bear. So I very politely excused myself. And I said, well, I wasn't sure that I was actually really cut out for this kind of thing. And please, you know, accept my apologies, but no, thank you. And exited.
How did you feel afterward?
I remember it was in the days long before cell phones. I remember I went to a payphone and I called the apartment where my boyfriend was and said, wow, wait till you hear what just happened to me. I think what I felt was speechless and also, well, frankly, I felt ashamed. I thought, you know, what did I think was going to happen? Reaching for something like a movie. I was a college kid. This was obviously way out of my league. And I can't say that I was traumatized. I was demoralized, I think, is what it was.
How did the experience affect your career aspirations and ambitions?
I can't probably say that there's a direct line between that experience with Harvey Weinstein and my research on the sexual objectification and sexualization of girls and women. But there certainly is a dotted line. These were the kinds of experiences that accumulated for me. You know, that wasn't the only time a man presented himself to me in an aggressive way, seeking something from me. It wasn't the only time my physical appearance was commented upon in a context when I would have rather been recognized for my competence. And that began to interest me. I returned to Smith. I majored in psychology. I went on to earn my PhD from Stanford. And I began to study what the consequences are to girls and women of living in a culture that routinely treats us as though our sexualized bodies are the most valuable thing we have to offer.
And Tomian, you know, do you think that the experience affected your interest in acting in the world of Hollywood?
Oh, absolutely. I really kind of threw that aspiration in the wastebasket, I have to say. At the time, I thought, as I said earlier, that this was just something I wasn't cool enough to be able to participate in. Ah, looking back, I can't believe that. What I do think that there was a whisper inside of me, some sort of feminist whisper that said, get out now. But at the time, I think what I thought was, okay, well, that was a learning experience, and now I am going to not pursue acting.
Catherine, I'd like to hear your story next. Can you describe how and when you met Harvey Weinstein and what happened?
Yes. So I was in my early 20s, and I had my agent set up a general meeting with Miramax, and I went to Tribeca and met with the people at Miramax, and Harvey was the guy I met with. And I remember there were other people there, women. He had one woman in particular that was his assistant, his primary assistant. And in the actual office, I felt very safe and like I was doing the right thing. And the meeting went really well, and he gave me two scripts to read. And you know, Miramax it was the early 90s, but they were doing interesting independent movies, and he made me feel like I was a fit there. And I had been spending the year auditioning. You know, I maybe got two guest spots or something, and the rest of the year was just auditioning. And here he was giving me this sort of validation, like, you're on the right track. Keep on. And at that point in my life, I needed to hear that, because you know, sometimes listening to her story, I think, God, I wish I'd taken a hard left and gone and studied psychology, you know, and done something more constructive. And I say that only because I think what happened was I did put so much hard work into acting. And after this incident, it was a profound incident for me. And it did affect the way I looked at my career. And there was, I think it pushed me back a lot. I stayed in it, but I had a conflict now. mm-hmm. that I was living with that made it much harder to pursue with the same zest and purity that I had once, you know, started with. But my story goes that as I left the office that day, on my way to the elevator, Harvey stopped me and he said, "Well, welcome to the Miramax family." And he used the word family to make, you know, making me feel very sort of included and cozy. Mm-hmm. And now you can come to screenings and all kinds of things and meet people. And I really felt like he was going to be a mentor. And he said, "In fact, there's a movie this afternoon. Are you available?" And I said, yeah. He said, "Okay, I'll have my car come pick you up." He did. We ended up going to a movie, the movie Red Rock West. Mm-hmm. And it was a Miramax movie, but we were just going to the theater on the Upper West Side.
Just like paying for tickets, popcorn in
basically,
the lobby.
Yeah. Yeah. With like 10 other people in the theater. And I sat there. I was mortified and already had the sort of sinking feeling that I'd been had, of course. And afterwards, I had to sort of orient myself and find my way to a subway stop and see how I was going to get home. And, you know, he had a car pick me up. It was all kind of strange. And he said, "Well, my apartment's right here. Will you come up for 1 second?" And I thought, "No, I'll just wait down here." And he said, "Just come up for 1 second." And he negotiated with me to sort of get me to come up to his apartment. And I thought, I didn't feel right about it, but then I thought, he's married. I know he's married. He's talked about his wife. He's too visible to do anything, you know? But I'm still uncomfortable, but I'm surely going to get out of it. We went upstairs. He made himself a drink. He was sort of inviting me to relax. We talked about art, movies, politics. And now I started feeling like, oh, okay, the meeting's back on. Like, he's getting to know me even more, you know?
And seemed interested in what you had to say.
Yeah, and I felt validated. And respected, like, and as an artist. And so, again, and maybe even safe, which is the strange part. And then he went to the bathroom, and he came back with the first time he came back with the robe on, and he asked me for a massage. And that was just already. That was just, I couldn't believe that it went into that place. I don't know why, again, like looking back, like, why was that so strange? But it was just so awkward for me. I was young. He was much older than me at that time. It really felt different, the age difference. And it was also just the touching, like wanting me to touch him was just so, it ruined suddenly the whole conversation. Everything was definitely off now. And I knew what it was about. And now I was just having to get out of there.
What did you say when he came out in the room?
Well, I said, "No, I'm not comfortable." He's like, "Well, everybody does it." And I said, "Well, I'm just not that person. Sorry." And I apologized, you know. And so then he went back and I thought he was going to get dressed. But then he came back and he came back fully naked. And that was when I went from just sort of shock to sort of adrenaline rush shock. Mm-hmm. And I remember feeling very much like, distinctly feeling like, is this the moment that happens to me? Like, it makes me emotional to think about it. But like, is it going to happen? Is that going to happen to me right now? I don't even want to say the word, but I was so scared. He's so big, and he's a big guy.
Yeah.
And he was between me and the door, and so then it became this sort of back and forth of, like, well, just let me kiss you. Just let me touch you. Just give me a massage. Just lift up your shirt and let me see your breasts. And I got mad. And I said, I can't believe you're doing this to me. And I told him, and I mean, I did a good job of, I think, sticking up for myself. Because over my dead body, was he going to, you know, have his way with me? And I knew that. Like, I was really, I thought that's kind of strength that you feel like when they talk about women that move cars for their children or something. I was like, no.
Right.
But it was a long negotiating process to get out of his apartment. And I finally got out. He said, I'll let you leave if you let me just get dressed. I'll take you in a cab myself. And I agreed to that, I think, because I felt like I should play nice the whole way. I think that that was the safest way to go. And then he took me in a taxi, and I got out at a bar downtown on the Lower West Side, and I just went into the bar, and I went right up to the bartender, and I said, just, can you please talk to me like you know me and like you're supposed to be meeting me here, because Harvey was in the taxi, and he was looking at me through the window of the taxi for like a good 20 minutes. Just the taxi was just still.
Just waiting outside the bar?
Staring me down.
That's so frightening.
It was so weird. It was so frightening and so eerie. And there was this, I mean, I knew that he knew he had done something wrong. And was he trying to manage it? Was he trying to threaten me? There was a lot of levels to him that I saw within this event. There was a little boy. Come on, just let me see your breasts. I mean, you know, this, and then there was this like, come on, you know, like bully and real tough, mean guy. I mean, it was a lot of levels of, you know.
And asking to see you out and drop you off almost seems like a attempt to assert normalcy. Like, we've just had a normal day together and I'm just dropping you off.
100%.
Yeah. Although then.
I mean, I was shaking the whole time in the car and the whole time at the bar. But I knew that I had to play along almost to get to my free spot.
Yeah. You described it as you were beginning to tell the story, how it left you feeling like you had a conflict in pursuing your career after that. Describe a little bit more what that conflict was.
Well, I just remember the next day thinking, I talked to my mom about it. Obviously, I kind of cried on her shoulder. And there was this kind of conversation about, well, what can you do? And it felt like, on my part, I just remember thinking, well, I can't do anything. I mean, I can't go up against this guy. He is Hollywood. Even then I knew who he was and who he was going to become. Mm-hmm. And I'm nobody. Who's going to believe me? Who's going to care? If I go up against him, he will snuff me out so fast. If I don't go up against him, either way, I'm living now with the new knowledge that there's only a few things people care about in Hollywood: money, sex, and the movies. They don't care about you. It doesn't matter. So unless you can play that tough, then maybe this isn't for you. And if sex is how you're supposed to, is the currency that you're supposed to use, I can't do it. I'm not made for it. And I spent all this money and time in acting school, and now I know I'm not made for this. All that being said, I just want to say, I know there are actresses who got through without doing that. Come on. You know, I mean, there are plenty of strong and talented, beautiful women who have made it, have made great careers for themselves. So I don't want to say that like that's the only thing that happens in Hollywood, but there was something about me that knew that day that this was going to be happen, and it could happen on such a high level that I just knew I didn't have any fight back, that whoever I talked to didn't have the power to do anything about it, or seem to care. And that then you see someone like Harvey continue to get celebrated over and over again.
Yeah, I want to ask all three of you what it was like to watch his ascent over time and the duration of it. But before I do, Alice, I'd love to hear your story, your encounter with
Yes.
Harvey was at Cannes in 2002?
2002 in Cannes. And I think I'd run into him before that time, kind of vaguely, but this one stood out. And I want to also say that my encounter was not in any way as harrowing as the two we've just heard. But the reason I wanted to speak was that when I first heard on something like the 6th or 7th of October that people had started to come forward and the New York Times and the New Yorker pieces had come out, I was like, finally. And then about 3 days later, I heard that he was denying it. And I remember feeling so angry because I know at least five or six women who have had horrendous moments with just absolutely horrible times in hotel rooms and bathrobes. And although my experience wasn't that, I knew that the only way to empower the women that had come forth already and for them not to be called liars was for more of us to come forward and say, we know that this man is an absolute vile creep. So my particular story happened in 2002. I'd been on a great role as an actress. I'd been an actress for about 6 years. I'd met in 99. I'd done me and my then boyfriend. Well, I'd met him on the film 102 Dalmatians. We were the two young leads in the film. And thanks to that, we'd had a few really good years, both of us working. He still does have a lot of good years at the moment while I'm looking after the kids. But he was in New York. I was in Cannes to promote a film that I'd done the year before. Things were very exciting. He was flying into Cannes a little bit the next day to promote a film that he'd done. So, you know, we were very much in love and it was amazing. And so it was my last night on my own in the hotel. And I went down to the bar on the beach and I was looking around for somebody I might have known. So I went, stood at the bar, and literally I turn around and Harvey Weinstein's right next to me. And my first thought was, oh my God, I'm going to get to meet Harvey properly. And it's really weird because this, I already knew that I'd heard from three or four. I'd actually met one girl in Paris after she'd come from her meeting with Harvey and seen her shaking. And so, it, just like you said, there was this mythical person who had the power to turn you into a Gwyneth Paltrow or anybody, whoever you want to choose. And I was like, oh my God. And then I was like, I don't. And also because of his politics, because of, you know, the way he promoted things like Sicko and all these, you know, I don't know if that was before or afterwards, but we all knew that he was a Democrat and so am I. And I thought he's intelligent and I'd love to talk to him. And I just thought, oh, what am I going to say? I don't know what to say. And I said, hi. And I said, I'm Alice. And he said, I know. You're so very clever. I don't know if he did know or not. And I said, my boyfriend, Johan Griffith, tested for you last night in New York. And he said, I know. And he did an awesome job. And that was just incredible because I was like, wow, he knows us. He knows, like, we're just these British actors. And oh, my God, I'm in Cannes. And I was just, oh, really? Did he really? And I was thinking, I can't wait to tell him. It's going to be amazing. He did an awesome job. He might be getting this big movie. And then something what you said just then, you said about the bathrobe and the moment when you went, oh, this is going to happen. I don't know how it transitioned. It was almost like it was an out-of-body experience. All of a sudden he was saying, I want to touch your tits. And we were in this full bar. And it was almost like, no, hold on, this can't be happening, but it is. And it's weird because when I was 18, I had a nasty car accident and the car flipped over and we landed on the back. And I remember thinking, oh, this is how I'm going to die. Like, and it was the same feeling. It was like, oh, my God, this is going to happen to me now. And he wanted me to go into a bathroom that was about 5 feet behind me. And he was moving in on my personal space, and he wanted me to go into the bathroom, into a cubicle. He was going to follow me. He was going to touch my breasts and my private parts, and it was just going to. And the weird thing is, I didn't say, "What the hell do you think you're talking?" I was saying, "Well, you know, I don't think I should because I've got a." I was coming out with ridiculous excuses, but as you say, you can't quite believe it's happening because, and it sounds crazy, but this is going to sound really awful. I thought that I wasn't the sort of girl that people come on to like that because I didn't give that vibe. Because I'm, and I think that's a horrible thing for me to say, but I think that, I kind of maybe thought that there were girls who did give that vibe, but that I didn't. And I don't, it hasn't happened to me a lot in my life because I think I'm quite clear about where I stand with people. It has happened more times, but I feel kind of stupid for thinking that it would be any different than that. So basically he just inched forward and I inched back and he inched forward and I inched back. And then it got to the point where it was very clear I was going to escape and run. And as I was escaping, he was like, whatever, I hope your career goes well. And I hope your boyfriend's career goes well. And 2 days later, we got the news that he, my then boyfriend and now husband, had not got the role. And my mother had just passed away. My father had just remarried. I was a little bit lost. I didn't have anybody to talk to. I confided in somebody, and my husband doesn't want me to tell this part, but somebody who was related to the team of people that were working for him, that was part of that. And I said, this thing happened, and I'm so sorry, and I don't know if it had anything to do with. And he was like, did you have to mention Johan's name? And I remember thinking, oh, shit, that's my... As if to say, well, you know, you didn't have to bring our client into this. And look, I don't blame him and I'm not trying to witch hunt him. But the weird thing was, is that for many years, all I could think of was, why did I say boyfriend? Why didn't I like it? And, you know, Johan never was called for Miramax and neither was I.
Well, I don't want to interrupt, but I know why you said your boyfriend.
Of course
you said because my boyfriend. You were making yourself safe immediately.
Yeah, you know what? You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right.
You were legitimizing yourself as an actor and your boyfriend too. And you were trying to meet Harvey in a business way.
Yeah.
Which is what you're supposed to do when you're an actor.
Yeah.
You know, we don't have... I was not going to say this, but I will say this. Actors... We can't, like, pick up our guitar and just play in our living room. We are completely dependent on someone to hire us.
Yeah, yeah.
You're not going to go do a monologue in your bedroom.
Yeah.
You know, you
right, you can't busk on the subway.
No, you can't. You can't pick up a paintbrush and paint in your room, which I do all the time for therapy. I might be terrible, but I get to do it.
You can't write in the, you can't, exactly. We absolutely are dependent on someone to hire us and then somebody not to edit us out at the end. But yeah.
And that, you might have helped your boyfriend get the job that night had you had a certain conversation with him and it had gone a certain way.
And I think one is constantly thinking that one, that's the way that we do think in Hollywood is like, you know, exactly that. So I think it was a combination of the two, you know, oh my God.
And not just in Hollywood, everywhere. People like to work with people they like.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Everywhere. And so if you make a connection with this man and he likes you and then finds out you have an interest in the similar, and then it might make him give Johan the job. That's why you brought his name up.
I think, what was crazy was when the person said, well, you could have just... the person didn't even say, like, I'm sorry, are you okay? The person said, I'm really angry with you for bringing up his name. I was like, yeah, I know, yeah, I'm sorry about that.
Well, it's like the thing that, she was saying in the beginning about shame.
Yeah.
I think all of us, she's saying she felt shame the first emotion that...
I'm struck by, in each of your accounts, Tommy Ann, you described this too. Each of you described your story and then you described a second layer where you were looking back and critiquing your own actions. I mean, you each had sort of built in, I was too apologetic, I was too this. It's striking. I mean, I don't know, Tommy Ann, what your response is to hearing these other stories.
I'm just so... First of all, when Alice starts by saying, you know, my encounter wasn't nearly as harrowing, already here you are apologizing women who all, you know, presented with, this moment in time. And Catherine talked about it, and so did Alice. There's this moment where you go, oh, hell. Uh-huh. Here comes, right? And so I think you mentioned your boyfriend also as a way of saying, here's a boundary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm going to name the fact that I have a boyfriend. And then you now the room starts spinning and you think, what are the rules here?
Exactly.
And then all of a sudden you realize here's what the rules are. The rules are simply because you are female. You are violatable. I'm going to violate your boundaries anyway. You can try to put some up, but here I come.
Yeah. And can I say something really interesting there? I was talking to my husband about this today, and because, you know, it's come up, the accusation with Al Franken has come up today, which is a little different, I think, to some of the ones that we've been hearing about Roy Moore, and I'm sure you have questions relating to that, maybe if we have time or whatever. But my husband said, "I'm terrified." I said, "Why are you terrified?" He said, "Well, if Al Franken's being accused because he tried to kiss this woman and put his tongue," he said, "that's happened to me before. I've got the wrong end of the stick." And I said to him, "You don't understand. For me, there are two completely separate types of men. There are the ones that maybe try and get the wrong end. And actually, I've tried with men and got the wrong end. And they've said no. And I've gone, 'I'm terribly sorry. I feel embarrassed.' And then there are the ones that you say no and you realize they're not going to stop." And I was trying to explain to my husband how completely different those two types of men were, and how, as far as I was concerned, that they weren't going to get mixed up. But then I realized that it was terrifying. It was going to be, at the moment, there are a lot of men thinking of that drunken time they had when they were 23, when they got the wrong end of the stick. And where does that leave us on?
You mean like a past gone awry? I was thinking a lot about this, and I don't know what Tommy Ann thinks, but I'd like to know, since she's a psychologist. But
yeah,
I know for me, like, my body had a very different reaction in this situation with Harvey than it has,
yes,
with a man that made a pass at me that,
yes,
I didn't want him to make
exactly
a pass at me.
Exactly what I was trying to say.
I had an out-of-body experience, uh-huh, with Harvey. And I was shaking like, uh-huh, a leaf. I think my adrenaline was through the roof. I have two or three situations where I saw him afterwards over, mm-hmm, the years. One of them, a friend of mine said to me the other night, "Oh, you know, Catherine, we went to the premiere of The English Patient together, and you threw up in the car on the way home."
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, now, God. I know why.
Oh, Jesus.
Totally blocked that out.
Wow.
I don't remember that at all. So, you know, I don't know if you, yeah, do that over, like, a past gone awry, yeah, or...
Well, it seems like it's about whether the person making the pass is actually curious about your answer, right? Like, whether it's,
yes,
whether exactly it's sort of a, "Hey, are we in the same place?" And they're concerned about where you are.
Exactly.
And,
yes,
and will respect it if you're not.
But what Jan, right, was, yeah, worried about was that somehow the two overlapped. And what I was trying to explain, and I've had maybe four or five Harvey-type encounters in my life, one with a famous rock star in a hotel room, which was a similar thing where I tried to get out the door and he slammed the door on me so I couldn't leave, and then I ran out shaking. Mm. It's so different. It's literally, "I'm going to get raped now." Whereas the past gone awry thing, the man feels embarrassed and you both feel embarrassed. And it's, I was trying to explain to him how different they were.
Right.
And it's, I think,
right,
it's hard,
well,
to put
one
into
takes
words.
You in, like you said, one is checking in with looping with, you,
yes,
in, and one is, mm-hmm, just like, "You're not there.
You're not a person."
A pass, mm-hmm, is a question,
yes,
and it's seeking an answer from another actual human being.
Right.
Damian, I'm curious whether you knew about Weinstein's reputation since you didn't continue to pursue a Hollywood career. Alice, you mentioned that you'd heard people who'd had stories, mm-hmm, even before you encountered him. And I'm curious, Catherine, to hear about the whisper networks and how much you'd learned about them too. But Tommy Ann, were you I think you've described in some interviews sitting at Oscar parties and kind of occasionally at ones where you felt like you were with the right crowd sharing a little bit of what had happened to you. But did you know that Weinstein had this reputation, that did you know that you weren't alone?
No. I mean, I just knew that I would ask, you know, "Is this a Miramax movie?" I remember The English Patient so well. I remember, it's so crazy that you say this thing that you threw up and you don't remember it, but I remember being sick in that movie.
Wow. That's so
weird. It's so strange, wow, that you're saying that.
I didn't remember. My friend just told me the other night, he took me to dinner and he said, "Do you remember?" And I was like, "What? No." And he goes, "Catherine, you barfed in the car."
Wow.
So you were sick watching it?
I think that, you know, all of those movies, Good Will Hunting, you know, they became just sort of sickening.
Yeah, no, I feel exactly the same. Yeah.
They became, yeah, you know, it would be an ordeal for me to get through them. And I would 100%. Think, of course, you know, this is a wonderful movie. And then you leave the theater and you're talking with your friends and everyone's saying what an amazing movie it was. And there's something rotten.
I know the feeling so well.
Yeah. And then everybody was saying, thank you, thank you, thank you, every time they got an Oscar to Harvey. And then to hear Kate Winslet recently saying that she was told to say thank you to him and she deliberately didn't. And now realizing that I was thinking, oh, there go all the people that managed to finesse their relationship with Harvey Weinstein.
I mean, there's been so much conversation both with Weinstein and then with the many men, almost too many to name, about whom allegations have come out in the last month. And there's been a lot of dissecting of these public apologies, and Harvey Weinstein's was certainly among the least effective documents we've seen. A lot of people spent time last week picking apart the apology of Louis C.K. and wondering whether, you know, it was good enough or not good enough. But obviously, a lot of those commentators are just people who know the work, people who've seen The English Patient, people who watched Louis. I'm curious for you guys whether what you would want out of an apology, whether any apology could be satisfying.
I don't personally think much of apologies. I've asked myself in many situations in life what I think about apologies, and I just don't. I think if somebody's done something that is neglectful or was done because they drank too much alcohol or they had a silly thought and they apologize, it's fine. But I think for certain things, I just don't think that apologies for me as a person who's the injured party. I don't know about how you two feel, because I feel that you two really, it was a different level of attack that happened to you two.
I don't know how I feel, because I am in general sort of like a very forgiving person, and I don't know if that has to do with me being a nice girl, or just an empathetic person that wants to believe that people that can change and that we're all born sort of pure. And, you know, I know that most abusers were abused. I mean, I think I would like to hear what our psychologist on the panel has to say about that, but everything I've read does suggest that, right? And I think that's a really interesting, important part of this. If
we're
going to correct,
I used to forgive people in general for things they'd done to me,
right.
And then I had some horrendous things happen with relationships in my extended family, and people did some really awful things to me, and I suddenly realized that I don't really need to forgive everybody, and if somebody thinks I'm a horrible person for that, then so be it. But right. I've never in my life knowingly hurt another human being, and I hopefully never will deliberately.
Right.
And
I understand what you're saying.
If I have to forgive somebody for something when in my heart I'm still bleeding, then I'm not in the right state of mind to continue the relationship with them anyway.
Right. I think there are a number of layers there. You know, there's research on apologies. There's research on forgiveness. And I will say that, you know, we've all been subjected to an apology that really felt nothing like an apology, right?
Yes.
And so here's the thing. When someone apologizes for our having been hurt, what they're saying is, I'm sorry you felt that way, right? And that is not at all an apology. An apology is about actually acknowledging the harm that your own action or inaction made happen, right?
Yeah.
And that is that's something that's quite hard to come by in any kind of public forum. We American rhetoric, there's no room for that. You never hear a politician do it properly. You never hear anybody do it properly. In our own intimate relationships, we can get in fights with the person we love the most, and we're so mortified that we've hurt them that we cling fiercely and we say, but I didn't mean to, but I didn't mean to, right? But then it turns out that our partner says to us, nevertheless, you did. And then we finally have to say, I am sorry, right? But that's rare. And I don't see very many genuine apologies in, you know, among these many, many now men who've been named as serial harassers or abusers. But then I think the second thing is so interesting. Forgiveness is such a puzzling phenomenon.
It is.
We know that clinically, forgiveness is a powerful, powerful source of rehabilitation in oneself.
For the forgiver or for the forgiven?
For the forgiver. And here's the trick. There are some conditions under which the forgiven doesn't even need to goddamn know.
Mm. Wow.
Why should they know? You can go through the process with your therapist, with your loved one, of finding a way to let go of the bond that exists between your powerful negative emotions and this event, right? And you can do that through forgiveness. But the person who harmed you doesn't ever need to know.
Yeah. Yeah, right. That makes perfect sense to me. Whereas some people think of forgiveness as something that you do to the person needs to be told that that they can forgive somebody else and therefore they feel sort of vindicated. Mm-hmm. It's more about the person doing it
about the damage that the rumination is causing in you. And so I think for me, the power of forgiveness is in between your own ears, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there are going to be some occasions where you will get a tremendous amount of healing by engaging in that process, but, you know, never letting the harm doer even know.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I'm curious just to know what it's been like for the three of you the last month. Particularly, you know, Catherine and Tomia, and you were in, I think, that second New York Times story, right in that first week of Revelations, sharing these things that you'd only discussed with a few people for years, even decades, you know, what has it been like to A, see so many other women come forward about Harvey Weinstein, and B, to be part of a set of people who I think are very brave, who seem to have triggered a massive cultural watershed moment, or at least we'll see what kind of change results from it over time. I'm curious to ask you guys about that too, but just what's the last month been like for you, Catherine?
It's been wild. I'm so touched and grateful to have met the women, even though I wish that it had never happened to them. I feel so close to you all. And it helps my healing. It really helps because I think the loneliness of feeling like it's just me makes the trauma of it worse. And I think that when you realize other people have been hurting too, and you're not the only freak that's hurting, that there's something really healing about that. And I'm also flabbergasted by how many women, I mean, like maybe every single person I know, every single woman I know is a Me Too.
Mm. Yeah.
I didn't know that would be the case.
Tomia, what's it been like for you?
Oh gosh. Well, it's been everything Catherine just said. Absolutely. But I think also I wasn't prepared for the kind of re-traumatization that would come from, I ended up having to make an outgoing message in my email that said, I have already told my story. And if that's all you want are the salacious details of that story.
Yes.
Don't contact me.
Exactly.
I'm happy to talk about the larger issues because we will not be quiet anymore.
That is exactly why I wanted to do this piece and not almost every other single offer I've had, is because they wanted, can we do a piece with Alice where she recounts to camera the anecdotes? And then, you know, that's just going to be the loop that will be just played again and again.
Yeah.
And
it is re-traumatizing.
Yeah. Whereas for me, it's much more important about what we're going to do, where we think this is going to go, what we think this means on a larger scale. And most of the channels I've had coming to me the outlets have wanted to hear the whole anecdote. Mm-hmm. I don't know why they would want to hear it when I wrote a piece in the Telegraph and I've told it on various different.
Yeah.
Tomia.
Yeah, I think in my case too, you know, I'm sure people who are very, very, they're very competent, they're very good at their job, but they know deep down that they got the job because their uncle was a friend of the CEO. And right now, this has turned out to be this this ironic, this sort of strange platform for me to talk about my career's worth of research on these issues. And so then I think, oh God, did it take having to tell this story to be able to?
God.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's such an interesting place that you just took it for yourself.
Yes.
Because I see it as, I think that we've been bursting to talk about this for our whole lives. I mean, come on. This is not, it's just, I mean, we just got to vote. You know, I mean, this isn't like, yeah, I mean, we're not, as women, come on, the way where we are right now in society, there, we have been is it right there at the tipping point? And this is the moment. You've been studying this, I think, because it's been an issue your whole life. And it's now, luckily, in this lifetime, we get to see people wanting to talk about it. I never thought we would. I don't know if you did, but when I first talked to Jodi Kantor from the New York Times, I was like, wait, this is a story?
Yeah.
You think this is a story? I minimized it so much that I just thought, you care about me?
Yeah.
No.
Right now?
Yes, exactly.
Are you serious? This can't be.
Tell me, Anne.
Yeah, I was meant to be grading exams, and I saw the first New York Times piece, Ashley Judd, and others, and I set my exams aside, and I wrote an email to Jodi Kantor, and I sent it on to my mother and my adult daughters, because I said, surely Jodi Kantor won't read this email, or certainly she won't care about my story. I'm a 54-year-old college professor. My God. And when the next morning she was on my voicemail, she called me. It's the same thing you're saying, Catherine. This is a story?
Mm-hmm.
You care about mine?
One thing that's been striking about these stories and some others that have come out is just it's not a corporation. There's not an HR department that you can call.
Right.
Now, as we're also learning that HR departments don't always handle everything well either, but kind of the fluidity of work in this industry, the fact that you're sort of setting up a new summer camp with every project and then going to the winds seem like they contribute to some of these dynamics. What steps do you think should be taken to prevent behavior like this from affecting the careers of women entering the industry?
I don't think you can take steps as, do you mean as far as legislation or I feel like it's very simple to me. It's not necessarily about men, women. It's about bullying.
Mm-hmm.
And I was bullied a lot as a child, and my mother she felt that she was very sort of inspired and empathetic, and she used to say, well, just think about what you might have done to them. And she said, you know, the best thing to do is take the high road. Sorry, fuck the high road.
You can swear on this podcast.
Okay, well, fuck the high road, because I tried for years and years to take the high road, and I tried ignoring them, and I'm doing little quote marks with my fingers there, because they just threw more ice lollies at my back and shouted things like slut, which was the word that everybody was called for some reason in England back in the 70s and 80s. And I had a horrible time. And it wasn't until I was about 14 when there was a girl that used to meet me every night after school, and she used to say, I'm going to beat you up. But not tonight, she said, another night. Ugh. So I would walk around with this terror. And then finally she said one day the same thing, I'm going to beat you up, but not tonight, tomorrow. And I just said, just do it. Just do it. And she punched me in the face. And I just looked around at her, and I just punched her back in the face. And then something took over me, and I grabbed hold of her hair, and I started repeatedly punching her back in the face. And we were having – I went to quite a rough school, I have to say. But we were having this full-on fight, and it was a massive changing point for me. And I realized that you cannot ignore a bully. And interestingly, my daughter, who's now 8 – in preschool, started being bullied in exactly the same way that I was. And I turned around to my daughter and I said, no, if somebody says something to you, anything, you have to say something back to them. And if somebody pushes you, you have to push them back. I don't care if that gets you into trouble, because I know from years and years that it doesn't get better if you appease somebody. It really doesn't. I think that's psychologically, does that make any sense to you, Tommy Ann, the idea that we should appease people and take the high road and being the wrong answer.
Well, but I think there's so many layers there. As we know, what did we each do to try to get out of our bullying encounter? We were very polite.
Yeah.
And we appeased this gigantic man because we didn't want to poke the bear, right? So mm-hmm. I think you have to equip your child with the wherewithal to understand that, you know, if you're at school and you have your teachers as witnesses, then you say right back to that bully, do not speak to me that way, right?
Yeah.
But you also have to allow for, and I wish we've heard from more women who ended up having to do the thing mm-hmm. to get out of the room.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
I don't feel like a hero. Mm-hmm. I don't feel like a hero that I, you know, left relatively unscathed. I think for a lot of women, the only way out of the room mm-hmm. is to
Well, Natasha Henstridge just beautifully spoke on the Today Show yesterday about Brett Ratner. She had encounters with Harvey Weinstein and Brett Ratner, mm-hmm. and the Brett Ratner one really, really, really upset her, and mm-hmm. she had to go through with the act because he wouldn't let her out of the room. Mm-hmm. And I've known Natasha for a long time. I didn't know this about her, and I teared up watching her mm-hmm. talk, mm-hmm. just thinking about.
Thank you. Right, we all get to sort of have people feel as though, you know, we were heroic because we didn't go along with it.
Yeah.
But in some cases, my God,
no, absolutely.
It's the only way you're going to save yourself.
Absolutely.
And we need to hear from those people too. I was going to say, if we are trying to talk about solutions, this is something so pie in the sky, but I was thinking, you know, in the music, in the world of music, in the world of the symphony, orchestra, et cetera, the people audition behind a screen. You are now judging their talent purely and solely by the sound that comes from their instrument, right?
Right.
And that was the way that industry managed to address things like racism and sexism. We don't see who the player is. We simply hear the music, right? Why can't we do something similar in Hollywood? Why can't we allow for people's talent to be the thing, right? There's digitizing. There's all kinds of ways we could make it so that we don't see the sexualized body and appearance of the person playing the audition.
Except for perhaps the fact that we're dealing with the visual image and that sometimes the visual image is a sexual one, possibly, or a charismatic one, then there would be the argument
charisma
that...
charisma and sexuality are confusing
yeah.
things, right?
And I'm you talk about your sweet, beautiful daughter already being bullied and you yourself being bullied, Alice. But of course, if you're female, the bullying will be sexualized. You will be called a slut.
Yes, that's so interesting. I didn't think of that. I just thought it must have been the word of the time because I hadn't done anything with any boys by that point. I mean,
Of course. That is the way to bully a girl. That is the way Harvey Weinstein bullied us.
Wow.
The last question I wanted to ask you guys, and you've done some of this already, which has been great, but is really just what you want to know from the other women who've been through this, and we'll start here with each other. But Tomian, I'm curious what you want to ask that you haven't had a chance to ask yet.
I think I've already been able to feel such a community, as Catherine, I think, also said, to confess to you all that I felt ashamed. Is so relieving because it helps me. The biggest forgiveness here is to my own self, right? I have to forgive my 20-year-old self for thinking that the only reason I didn't go along with this was because I was a chicken or a prude or something. And so I guess I'm wondering if you have found ways to forgive yourselves.
I find it very hard to forgive myself about anything.
It's hard, right?
It's really hard.
I had a couple moments of feeling very loving towards my 23-year-old self, 24-year-old self. Like I want to say, hey girl, you know, like if you could see me now, if you could see what's happening now, you know. Yeah, I'm glad that girl got to grow up and be this girl.
Yeah, and I think one thing that comes to mind for me, and I saw this a lot on some of the negative comments in Twitter, were there was one person that went into a fight, and I suddenly had about 10 people, amazing people, defending me, who said, you wanted the bright life. You wanted to be a famous star. You wanted to be rich and famous. Ha, you should have chosen a normal job like everybody else. And I thought it was interesting because I think that in myself, I've always felt guilty because maybe I was brought up not to want to choose a job that was sort of vain and self-aggrandizing, perhaps, if one succeeded. And that somehow these people had now caught me out. Because, and I think especially in England, we're not, little kids aren't taught that they can be president, not just because we don't have a president, but because it's you're supposed to pretend that you don't want to achieve anything. You know, success is not a quality in England. You're supposed to say, well, no, of course, I don't want that. And all of us, and I had a hard time coming out to myself that I did want to go into this business. And everybody sort of, they always love to nuance it. Well, of course, for me, the theater, and of course, for me, it's always about, you know, it's an ensemble thing, and it's not, you know, most people are show-offs that want to go into acting. And all of a sudden, these people were coming out and saying, well, you see, well, if you wanted to go into that, then you deserve whatever you get.
Yeah.
And I think, no, actually, no. Because this is my job, and this is what everything I've ever done in my life, everything we have, our lovely house with our lovely pool, our lovely kids, is paid for by acting. Therefore, it's a legitimate job that we're doing, and therefore that's why I was scared, was because we don't have any other skills. You know, unless I want to go back on my French and Italian degree from like 100 years ago, which I mean, I can still speak them, but I'm not sure anybody wants a French to English translator. Like, hello. But so we have made a living from acting, and it is viable, and it's okay to want to be an actor. And people that are growing up now should be allowed to know that, you know, you can want to be famous. Mm-hmm. That's not successful.
Yes.
Or to earn money. And you can want to be in the spotlight. And that doesn't mean that then if things go like this wrong, you have to accept.
Right. And storytelling is a healing art.
Yes.
Whether you're behind the mic.
Yes.
Or, you know.
And an art that's been around forever and ever and ever. And yes.
We need storytelling in our culture. It helps heal us.
Yeah.
And so there's no reason to diminish it. And some characters in movies are sexy, you know?
Yeah.
And they shouldn't be, you know, subject to being raped because of it, you know?
I thought you were going to say some characters shouldn't be, because sometimes I'll go up and it says, you're going up for Amber, and she's 39 and she's got 4 different degrees, but she touts a gun and she's also knows how to take out a brain and, you know, and she's incredibly sexy and always wears her hair down. And I'm just like, oh, that one again. Yeah, I can do that one easy. Yeah.
The other thing that has struck me over all of these stories is, my God, we're resilient.
Hey, yes.
Yeah.
Nice. Yes.
Yeah.
We shouldn't have to endure these things, but we do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Every single
and
woman.
Some people endure a lot worse and have endured a lot worse, and they don't have a platform.
Yes.
Yeah, they don't.
And that's why we need to use our platform.
That's why there's something more needs to happen from this.
Yeah.
That's why there needs
to be a next step. Yeah.
You know, for other people's voices to be heard. Mm-hmm. People that don't have a platform.
Yep.
Thank you all so much for sharing your time and your stories with us today. It's been a real privilege talking to all three of you. Thank you, Tomi Ann.
Thank you so much. It was wonderful to meet all of you.
Thank you, Catherine.
Yes, thank you so much.
Thanks, Alice.
This has been great.
Thank you. Thank you. It's been like a therapy session for me.
You've been listening to a special Slate podcast with three women who have accused Harvey Weinstein of sexual harassment. You heard from Tomi Ann Roberts, Catherine Kendall, and Alice Evans. One note, Evans mentioned some allegations against Brett Ratner. Ratner's lawyer has categorically disputed the allegations against him from actress Natasha Henstridge and several others, including more women whose accounts were published since this conversation was recorded. You can read a transcript of this interview at slate.com. I'm Julia Turner. Thanks for listening.